From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about acting with the celebrated actress and acting teacher, Uta Hagen. She began her career over 60 years ago and has worked with such legends as Eva Le Gallien, Alfred Lunt, Lynn Fontaine, and Paul Robeson. She runs the HB Acting Studio, which was founded by her late husband, Herbert Berghoff. Uta Hagen is now starring off-Broadway in the show Collected Stories. Also, David Bianculli reviews Anatomy of a Homicide, a behind-the-scenes look at the TV series Homicide, and Lloyd Schwartz reads two poems written about his 94-year-old mother who has Alzheimer's. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. It's the day after Election Day, and Democrats in California have won two big races. Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis defeated Republican Attorney General Dan Lundgren for the governorship. Incumbent Senator Barbara Boxer beat Republican State Treasurer Matt Fong to keep her job. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Both Davis and Boxer won their respective races by broadening their voter base and winning over moderate swing voters. Both successfully portrayed their opponents as right-wing extremists, and both won huge majorities among women, minorities, and labor households. Davis also attracted two Republicans to his cause for every Democrat who voted for the Republican Lundgren. For the first time in 120 years, a Latino was elected to a statewide office. Assemblyman Cruz Bustamante will be California's new lieutenant governor. In other results, voters approved a measure making it easier for Indians to build casinos on their tribal lands, and voters overwhelmingly approved a $9 billion bond issue to reduce class size and repair older schools. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
Meanwhile, more than 200 ballot measures were considered in 16 states. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The vote to end state affirmative action programs was overwhelming, and proponents of the measure hope last night's victory will provide the momentum to pass similar affirmative action bans in other parts of the country. California already has such a ban. In Oregon, voters passed a measure to require vote-by-mail ballots in biennial primaries and general elections. This practice is being examined by many other states as well. The most expensive initiative campaign this year, and indeed the most expensive initiative campaign ever, concerned tribal gambling in California. Although Las Vegas gambling interests spent tens of millions of dollars to defeat it, Californians passed a measure that could expand gambling on Indian land. Finally, on the thorny question of doctor-assisted suicide for terminally ill patients, voters in Michigan overwhelmingly rejected the idea. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
A Michigan jury has convicted euthanasia supporter Dr. Jack Kevorkian of two misdemeanor charges. These stem from a confrontation with police outside a hospital where Kevorkian had gone to leave a body. An associate of Kevorkian connected with the same incident was acquitted. Kevorkian was immediately sentenced. He'll have to pay a fine. If he doesn't, he'll need to serve 60 days in jail. The FBI is trying to find a Vermont man wanted for questioning in the murder of a doctor who performed abortions. Authorities are trying to find James Kopp because they believe he has information that could help them. The Buffalo News reported this week New York police were checking why a Vermont man with ties to the anti-abortion movement was jogging near Dr. Barnett Slepian's home before he was murdered. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 122 points at 88.28. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, investors appear to be relieved that the 1998 midterm elections are over. There is also positive news today for computer stocks and new economic numbers from the government. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
With the dust having settled from the elections and no huge shifts in terms of Republican or Democratic congressional seats, Wall Street has apparently decided to celebrate with a post-election rally. Stocks began moving sharply higher shortly after the opening bell today. Blue chips are up for the fifth time in 6 days. Investors are buying shares of Cisco Systems and Intel amid optimism about their future earnings. Entertainment giant Viacom also reports its third-quarter profits were higher than analysts had expected at about $157 million. And Aetna, the largest U.S. health insurer, says third-quarter earnings fell 6.1%, slightly more than $152 million. Meanwhile, the Commerce Department reported today factory orders for the month of September rose 0.4%. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Los Angeles Times newspaper says it will cut about 250 jobs, or about 4% of its workforce. Managers say they want to make the paper more efficient. The paper's president says these reductions are part of the first of three cost-reducing moves. The other two moves are to be announced at the end of the year. The Los Angeles Times is one of the largest daily metropolitan papers in the country. For the first time in over 100 years, National Geographic magazine will be sold at newsstands. The monthly magazine has been available by subscription for only more than a century. The National Geographic Society says starting with the November issue, the magazine will be available at newsstands in 80 cities across the country. An issue will cost $3.95. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've heard many actors say with reverence that they studied at the HB Studio in New York. That's the studio run by my guest, the celebrated actress and teacher Uta Hagen. The studio was founded by her late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in 1945. Some of the actors who studied there include Jack Lemmon, Stockard Channing, Matthew Broderick, and Lily Tomlin. Many actors have studied Uta Hagen's books, Respect for Acting and A Challenge for the Actor. Uta Hagen started her acting career over 60 years ago and worked with now legendary people including Eva Le Gallien, the Luntz, and Paul Robeson. She was born in Germany and moved to Madison, Wisconsin at the age of 6 when her father accepted a position teaching art history at the University of Wisconsin. In 1995, Uta Hagen starred in the title role of Mrs. Klein off-Broadway. Now she's starring off-Broadway in Collected Stories. She plays Ruth Steiner, a prominent writer and teacher who lives alone. I asked her to describe the story.
The play is about her relationship to a young protege, who develops into a protege, a young writing student. And they form a very, very close relationship, and like mother and daughter. And eventually the young writer betrays her by taking material that and personal things of the teacher's life, and capitalizing on it, and it's actually a play about betrayal, as to me at least.
Now, is there a relationship that you were able to draw on in preparing for this role?
Well, betrayal is something I think everybody has experienced, and that's why I think the play has such a reaches so many people on that level. To trust someone, to take someone into one's life and form a close relationship and then have that relationship abused and used for personal gain, I think is not uncommon, unfortunately. And I think that's thematically what it's about.
I guess I'm wondering, too, if you've ever been wary of students who you've become very close to feeling that at some point they might cross over a line.
No. But you see, in acting, it's different. They can't steal anything of mine. I'm offering most everything in my techniques, but they have to do it on their own, and they can't. When you're good, it's very hard to have anybody copy you.
You once said that at your age, and you're, I think, 79 now, it's hard to find roles that aren't about Alzheimer's disease.
Isn't that the truth? Or that have to do with intelligent people and functioning people. It's very difficult.
Is that very frustrating for you? Would you like to?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. I mean, when I found Mrs. Klein, I was so thrilled, which is the last play I did. And I went into doldrums. I thought I'll never find another challenging role. And then my director, William Carden, who's also the director of the artistic director of the HP Playwrights Foundation, where I work, is found this play, and I just flipped, and I've been happy ever since last January when I began working on it.
Let me ask you a question that I hope you don't misinterpret, but I think most people find that once they're in their 30s, their memory starts to not be as good as it was. And everyone I know seems to be struggling with this. I'm wondering if over the years, if you felt any sense that your memory isn't as sharp as it once was, and if you have to, like, learn lines in a way any different from the way you used to when
No.
you were much younger.
No. It takes me longer to learn lines because I learn them correctly and not because my memory's gone. But when if people memorize lines mechanically, they're learning them wrong anyway, and I can do that very quickly. People say I'm a fast studier. I said, so am I if I just want the mechanics. But if I want to know what I'm talking about, to learn the content of what I'm talking about, and have the words become inevitable through my connection with their meaning, that takes a long time.
You're known as a great teacher as well as a great actor, and you've written a couple of books about acting. You write that there are hundreds of different people within you who surface through the day, within anyone who surface through the day. Do you recommend that actors find the person within them that's closest to the role that they're playing?
Well, it isn't one person in you. In other words, when you create a role, you are selecting from various aspects of your life and putting it together to create that new character. But all of that has to spring from your understanding of yourself. And that's what takes so long.
You say that an experience that has served you many times, including when you played Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, is an experience from your childhood when you were like pelted with hard snowballs by kids in the neighborhood, and you were called an atheist. What is it from that scene that stayed with you so much, from that experience? And
well, it was a bitter, cold winter night. I was hounded through the streets with snowballs by children. That's terrifying. I'd never forgot it. It was just like being in hell.
What is it from that experience that you summon up when you need to for a role?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering if there is a kind of experience that is so frightening or rich for you, if you've used it to draw on several times for roles, does the experience dry up? Does it lose its power to have that energy for you?
As a matter of fact, that experience might wear out because I've talked about it a lot. If you don't talk about it a lot, it stays useful. When you explain to an audience, to somebody, a friend or, a colleague who's working with you, what sources you're using, if you tell them that, your secret is gone. Now they look at you with that knowledge of what you're using and judging it, and you can't use it anymore.
That's interesting. So you won't talk about these things with the people you're performing with?
No.
But you'll talk about it with your students?
Not what I'm using in the immediate role. I give them examples like the snowball.
Right.
Now that's used up for me because I've talked about it a lot.
In one of your books about acting, you talk about how you can't be inert on stage and you have to find out what it is that you actually do while you think you're doing nothing so that you could do that kind of thing on stage. Have you thought about that a lot, what it is you're doing when you're...
I'm going to interrupt you right now.
Go ahead.
Because, again, everything you're discussing, you have read. It interests you. Are you an actor?
No, I'm not.
Then it's none of your business. Now, let me explain to you why. It may interest you, may fascinate you. But if, you see, I feel that in the theater, everybody thinks they can act. Everybody is fascinated about another human being on stage. If it's very convincing, they usually are sure that they could do it too, which is not true at all. If you would go to a violinist, you would not ask him about his bowing arm, about his elbow position, about his phrasing. And if he told you, you wouldn't know what he was talking about, and you would be bored. If you went to a painting class and a watercolor class, and you saw a teacher showing somebody how to wash a piece of paper that is going to have watercolor put on it in a minute, you'd say, "What do they teach here? How they're watering down a page?" These are not the secrets, but the craft itself. You wouldn't ask a scientist because you wouldn't know what he was talking about, and you must. I feel an audience should learn to respect acting as a craft in the same way that if I do explain it, it might titillate you. You might understand a little of it, but the real impact or import of it for a fellow artist, you would not get.
I don't
say that to offend you. I just believe that with all my heart.
I want to say I totally respect what you're saying, but I just beg to differ on a couple of things. That for example, I would be asking the violinist about their phrasing and their... the bend of their arm and all of that.
Why?
Well, because I think...
Do you play violin?
No, but...
Then I think you might ask him, but I think the violinist would look at you like you were nuts, and I think you are.
No, see, but what I have found as someone very interested in these things is that, for instance, if the violinist talks to me about his or her phrasing, it might help me hear music, hear things in music that I didn't hear before. I find that actually understanding more about craft is not only interesting in its own right, but helps me perceive things that I didn't perceive before, which I like.
That's a very valid point. And maybe I'm just in reaction to so many people who ask these questions without and the misunderstanding in of the layman in terms of an acting technique are so profound that I think I've pretty much had it in my life with that. I think that's probably part of my rebellion.
I'll tell you another reason why I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about acting, though I respect you for not wanting to talk about this, is that I think really good actors have great insights into the body and how the body is used, how the body communicates, how the voice communicates, and also that great actors are great observers of other people, and they just have great insights into
That's true.
How people
and I
move.
Think, but you see, the body again, which I'm a gung-ho about. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about it all the time, and I believe that the body as a instrument of communication is all-powerful. And the biggest influence in my life for that training came from modern dance, without being balletic or dancerish, but it very strongly influenced me. However, very fine actors very often cannot define themselves what it is they are doing. Lorette Taylor could not tell you what she was doing. She had no idea. She was intuitive, instinctive, great performer.
I've certainly noticed that as an interviewer, that some of the really great artists I've interviewed.
God, some of the best ones And I happen to have, because I've been teaching, and I found in my own work that very often, when I couldn't explain something, it was because I didn't understand it myself. Mm-hmm. When I couldn't articulate it, it was because it was fuzzy in my own head. Now, I do know that I can do it, nevertheless, but I may not be able to communicate it to someone else.
Perhaps you'll let me ask you about the voice, since I do speak on the radio.
Yes.
I know that you've recommended singing lessons for people who aren't necessarily going to be singing on stage but are just going to be speaking. What do you feel you've learned about your voice from studying singing? I'm assuming you've studied it.
I did. You see, it's the same with when I say dance, modern mm-hmm. dance, for mm-hmm. the body of the actor, which does not make them self-conscious about stage movement, but gives them a sense of alignment, a sense of an awareness of their body and space. In the same way, singing, rather than voice for the theater, makes them not listen to themselves. It prepares the vocal instrument, the diaphragm, the whole tone of the voice in the head. Without making you now listen to yourself when you talk. Do you understand what I mean? The self-consciousness, when it makes you listen how it sounds, you're going to be a bad actor. The voice has to be there for you to serve you when the time comes.
Right. So you're not worrying about how you're doing your lines.
Exactly.
You're learning about the sound and physicality of your voice.
Exactly. It's there from the singing. It serves, the instrument is ready. It's primed.
My guest is actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. She's now starring off-Broadway in the play Collected Stories. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Your acting career was launched by what I perceive to be as a very bold gesture. When you were, I think, 17, you wrote a letter to Eve Le Gallienne asking if you could work with her.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very brave thing to do.
I didn't even think it was brave. I was also very stupid. I thought she still had the civic repertory, which I knew, had read a great deal about and heard about. And it was the only repertory company in America at the time, or there hasn't been one since, I don't think, a real repertory company. And she was doing great plays and contemporary new playwrights and Ibsen and Chekhov and Shakespeare. And that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be a part of that. And based on that, I wrote her and I said, this is what I want, and could I audition for you, and I want to be a part of your theater. And didn't realize that the Civic had already folded, and she was still functioning, but not in that capacity. And then she was working on a production of Hamlet, which I didn't know. And I went home after my audition with her, and in spring of 36, no, 37. And then my father wanted me to go to college, and because at that time you couldn't get a job at Macy's if you didn't have a degree. It was during the Depression. And I was itching to just go into the theater. I didn't want to do college, so I thought I'll do it in a 3-year plan and take summer school. And I went to enroll in summer school and came home, and there was a letter from Miss Leganin asking if I would be interested in coming east and working with her on Hamlet. And that was my debut in the theater, Ophelia.
Now, was that letter based on her having seen you, or just based on your letter?
No, based on my letter.
What?
My letter to her.
What did you say in that letter?
I don't know.
That led to that invitation.
I really don't know how I used to persuade people that I was fabulous, because I guess I believed it. And I don't know how I interested. My agent said to me, who was my agent at the time, she said, I don't know, when you walked in, you knew you were great, so we believed it. And I don't think I had egomania at all. I just believed I had a big talent and I was going to be a great actress.
So what was it like for you playing Ophelia so early in your career?
I don't remember. You see, it's all like a haze and blur. It was a wonderful experience. And then in essence, I studied with her, because I worked with her in the play and that whole company with fencing lessons, and we had all sorts of extracurricular things we were asked to do. And we wove our own costumes at her looms. And it was a phenomenal experience for me. And then when that was finished, which went very well at Dennis, we played it in Dennis, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and got wonderful reviews from Elliot Norton and all the fine Boston critics. And then she was going to do eight plays in repertory and work on it for 3 years. She had a huge grant for that, and I was going to be part of that. And then I rehearsed with her for 3 months, and she abandoned the whole thing because she felt the company wasn't good enough, which I don't think it was. And so I worked with her on The Seagull. I worked with her in other roles in the fall. And then at Christmas, the whole thing was collapsed. And then I went on to do The Seagull with the Lunts. I don't believe it. When I laugh, it's because it's like some fairy tale.
Well, before we go on to your experience with the Lunts, you mentioned that you had fencing instruction when you were with Eve Leganin. I mean, have you ever had to fence in a role? What is the point of studying fencing?
Oh, fencing is like tennis for an actor. It's the ideal sport to learn. For agility, for give and take, for spontaneity, it's fabulous.
I always thought that that actors studied fencing in case they were playing a period piece. But you're saying that they study fencing to be more physically responsive.
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
It's like I very often compare really good actors with very great tennis players. In other words, the give and take, the receiving and sending is the spontaneity and the immediacy of that. Once you sense that, then you know what acting is all about.
Now, you worked with Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine on Broadway in The Seagull. These are like great names of the theater, but most people today have never seen them perform and know them only through legend. What were they like? What was so special about them?
Well, they were an enormous influence on my life. They, just if I say only one thing, of discipline. I've never what they pounded into me in terms of theater discipline has never left me. And I've tried to pass that on because I'm very shocked most of the time at young actors who don't understand what a disciplined performer is like in terms of the simplest things of your own health, of your rest, of your readying yourself for work, of the hours you put into work. I can work 12 hours in a row and not fall down. And the respect for the craft, for the love for the theater, the need to make it into a true offering for an audience. I mean, I knew some of these things before, but they were kind of reconfirmed, and I saw it in practice. They were phenomenal.
When you say they taught you discipline, could you elaborate on what it was that they taught you that helped you with discipline?
Well, they were disciplinarians in the toughest sense of the word. You were, if your curtain was at 8:30 in those days, your half hour was at 7, at 8, you were in the theater at 6:30, and not a moment later. Somebody like Clarence Derwent, who was the president of Equity at one point, very prominent actor, played with them in The Pirate, and he played the part of the pirate who didn't appear until the third act. That was at 10 o'clock. He was still in the theater at 6:30. And the no-nonsense backstage, never, you don't drink during the day. You don't come to the theater in a messy state. You look after your costumes. Miss Fontaine used to sit with me trying to teach me a decent makeup, which I'd had classes in for years. And she would smack my hands if while I was putting on my eyebrow pencil, said, no. She'd say, you make up not for the last row gallery with opera glasses, but for somebody in the front row with opera glasses. And that's what I'm talking, and how that you don't have on a beautiful costume and have a malted milk and spill it in your lap. In other words, everything had to do with true care about everything you did and everything you brought to a performance.
Uta Hagen, she's now starring off-Broadway in the play Collected Stories. Her latest book is called A Challenge for Actors. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Uta Hagen. Lloyd Schwartz reads two poems about his conversations with his 94-year-old mother who has Alzheimer's. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Anatomy of a Homicide, Life on the Street. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with celebrated actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. She's now starring off-Broadway in the play Collected Stories. She runs the HB Acting Studio in New York, where she's taught since the late 40s. She started her acting career over 60 years ago and has worked with now legendary people. In 1943, you played Desdemona to Paul Robeson's Othello. What was it like to work opposite Robeson?
Well, it was wonderful. He was unbelievably overused term, but charismatic man with a great presence, an enormous intelligence, sense of humor. He was a great, great man.
Was there anything that was considered controversial about the production?
Everything was considered controversial. That's why.
Because so often Othello was played by a white actor in blackface.
It was the first time in this country. No, mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe in some. I just was trying to think who else had played it. I don't want to have history cockeyed here. But it was, for a Broadway production, way ahead of its time in that sense. And that made it very controversial and very exciting. And no trouble at all. Everybody was thrilled with the idea that this was finally happening.
Now, am I right in saying that you were later blacklisted?
Oh, yes, I was blacklisted for 10 years.
And
as a matter of fact, I was graylisted. In 1970, I did a production for CBS, and I said to, there was a woman producer called Barbara Schultz, and I said, did you have any trouble getting me on? And she said, oh, God, yes. That was still in 1970.
And do you think that that related at all to your work with Robeson?
It did.
And your friendship with Robeson?
It did, no question about it. I also was a progressive and a political, what would I still call myself, a liberal, left liberal Democrat. I always was, and I always will be. And it was that one time in my life when I would say I was very proud to be an American citizen because I felt I was very active as such. And the blacklisting and the what happened to me as a result, I say the government still owes me an apology.
So you lost a lot of roles that you think
well,
you would
of course.
Have had. Yeah.
Oh, I know. And it was at the kind of the most fruitful part of my career. I had just done Blanche for 2 years. I had done The Country Girl. I had done St. Joan. And suddenly, and I was beginning to get big television offers. I never got another television. I never got another film offer. St. Joan was supposed to go on the road. I couldn't go on the road because they were writing the Guild protest letters from Indianapolis, from all over the country. And And the worst thing they did, I don't really care, I say, about that, because I think, in a way, maybe it prevented me from being tempted by movies and stuff that I would have been sorry I did afterwards. But what they did to me spiritually was that it's the only time in my life I was ever frightened. I've never been frightened of anything in my life. And that scared me, and that's what I resent most.
Did you have to testify?
Twice. I mean, I was called twice. I only testified once eventually in private session. But those were horrible days. Those were days when you sat in a restaurant, and if you started to talk politics, you looked over your shoulder to see if a waiter was listening was going to report you. My phone was tapped. I was followed by the FBI. And nobody ever even asked me to be a communist. That's what's so ironic about that whole time.
Back to acting. In 1947, you worked with the director Harold Clurman, and you say that he took away all your tricks and
yep.
brought you into a more modern approach to acting. What were the tricks that he stripped you of?
Well, the tricks, what you learn, actually, he stripped me of stuff that I had acquired as a professional, which was pretty junky, you know, but Broadway tricks, you tell a funny joke just before you enter the stage, that makes you into a professional, which is junk. And slick entrances and how to sit and how to move gracefully and self-aware and theatrically, externally theatrically phony, which I did not begin with, by the way. As an amateur, I said, Clurman led me back to being a good amateur, which is that I believed who I was, I believed where I was, I had faith in what I was doing, I was not dishing it out front for consumption, And he wouldn't let me do, I had learned to fix line readings, to fix gestures, and he didn't let me do any of that, and I got back to where I'd been, and I only now I believe that it could be done that way and wasn't amateurish, but was true.
You met your late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in the theater. He was an actor and teacher, and you run the studio that he founded. Did you meet him in a play? Were you on stage together?
Yes, we were in a play with Klerman, as a matter of fact. It was the same play called The Whole World Over by Konstantin Simonov. Not a very good play. And he was a replacement, and I had heard about him, and through many of my acting colleagues, many of them studied with him. I thought he was a phony, he was a guru. At the few meetings I had with him, I thought it was a strange man. And then we started working together, and were love scenes, and a couple of kisses, and a couple of hugs, and a week later we hit the sack, and we never left.
No, I've
44 years later.
I imagine it's a very kind of intensified experience to be in love with somebody on and off stage, to enact this dramatic love on stage and to also feel it off stage.
I don't think it's that so much. It's working together. I think it needn't have been a love scene for us to fall in love with each other.
Uh-huh. But
what was extraordinary about our relationship from then on was that we truly did everything together. I mean, we had he'd got me into teaching. He's the one who started me teaching. And I said, I don't know how to teach. Why do you want me to teach? And he said, you know how to act. Can't you learn to pass on what you've learned? And when he put it that way, I thought, that'll be fun. And then from then on, I loved it. And we had the studio together, and we played together for many, many years. And he directed me in many plays. And it was a unique, fabulous life that I still can't believe is gone.
My guest is actress and teacher Uta Hagen. Did you ever study, you know, the method?
No, never. I mean, I've read all of Stanislavski's books avidly when I was young, and I still have my old copies that are all underlined with "so true" on the side, you know? I didn't really know why. And I also remember thinking, why can't I do what he's telling me when I get on stage? As a matter of fact, when I was asked to write my book, I was actually commissioned to write the first one by Macmillan. I said, it can't be done, and it drove me crazy, because I said, I can demonstrate something in 1 second that it takes me 30 pages to write. And got so bored with it. But my books are actually based on things that gave me problems as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And every exercise, every thing I came up with was based on my own problems, sharing those with other actors, which I think most of those problems every actor has had himself. When people say, oh, how do you know that? I say, because there isn't a mistake I haven't made. There isn't a mistake in the book that I haven't made 10 times, 100 times. So then I see it in someone else, then I can help them get rid of that problem.
You mentioned that first book about acting that you wrote. You've, in a way, disavowed that book, and you have a second book about acting. What was the problem with the first book?
Well, when I was watching an exercise in class, and I was appalled, and I very rarely get impatient, and this time I did, and I said, my God, what's the matter? Didn't you read my book? And she said, yes. And I said, where does it say to do what you just did? She brought me the book, and there was some sentence there. I said, oh, no. And I hadn't looked at the book in 12 years. I took it home. I reread it. I said, this has got to go. And I immediately started to revise it and spend another 5 years writing the new one. And theoretically, I agree with many of the things in the first book. But it's cute. It's superficial. It's convenient. I think it can be misinterpreted. I teach all of it. I've taught a lot in colleges. They say, I'm working from your book, and they're doing the opposite of what I say. They have managed to say what I wrote and interpreted the opposite. So I thought, this mustn't be. So I wrote the new one, and I think people might not like it as much, but they and they might disagree with it. You can't even disagree with the first one. It's so general.
I wonder if you have actors who you've taught, who you've seen changed by working in Hollywood and achieving stardom there.
I've seen, well, if they're talented and manage to get over the idiocy of Hollywood, they usually change for the better, but if or they improve. But if they, I've seen professional actors, stars, whom I worked with, who were theater actors, who were quite extraordinary and wonderful. And they go to Hollywood for 6, 7, 8 years, and they do sitcoms or they do nothing but movies, and they come back and they are scared to death. They cannot sustain a performance. They tense up. They have not used their bodies. They're all used to close-ups, and have really lost their ability. And that's a fact. I know 4 very specific examples that were you shudder.
Do you have a performance tonight of Collected Stories?
Yes.
Is there anything special that you do on the day of a performance?
Yes. I do as little as possible. And I will go home now from this interview and eat by about 3. And then at 4, I will lie down. And I will get up at 5:30 and start making up in my home. And then I will go to the theater at 6:30 and be there at 7:15. And then I will play at 8.
Well, let me let you return into your preparation for tonight's performance. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. I thank
you
very
much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope I wasn't irritating you.
No. I respect all of your opinions on this, even if I do differ on some of them. But it's really been a pleasure, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Uta Hagen is now starring off-Broadway in the play Collected Stories. It runs through January 3rd. Her latest book is called A Challenge for the Actor. You can hear her voice in an upcoming episode of King of the Hill. Coming up, Lord Schwartz reads 2 poems about his mother, who has Alzheimer's disease. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is also a poet, and recently he's been writing poems about his mother. She has Alzheimer's disease and is in a nursing home. A few weeks ago, his mother's nursing home hosted a national symposium on aging and Alzheimer's disease, and Lloyd was asked to read some of his poems. He says it turned out to be a more moving experience than he expected.
I was a little apprehensive at first, reading poems to a group of distinguished doctors, clinicians, and healthcare workers. What could my poems tell them that they didn't already know? I decided to read 3 poems that were not only about my mother, but in which she herself speaks. My mother is 94 years old. One way these poems are important to me is that they are my way of keeping her voice alive. Although her memory has radically deteriorated, she's still very much herself, far from the non-entity Alzheimer's patients are often thought to be. And every now and then, out of nowhere, she'll remember something astonishing. My mother has spent her whole life giving me things. What she has to give me now are the things she says. The 2 Horses, A Memory. You said you had lunch in Pittsfield. Was it on North Street? That reminds me of when we lived on the farm. It must be 80 years ago. We went to a 1-room schoolhouse. Didn't you drive past it once? Each row was a different grade. I sat in the first seat of the first row. The teacher's name was Miss Brown. She was so pretty. I wonder if she's still alive. the day before we left the farm, our cat disappeared. We couldn't find her anywhere. I was sad for weeks. 3 months later, she showed up at our new house in Pittsfield. Robbins Avenue. I can't think of the number now. My sister was in New York. She didn't like the people she was living with, so she'd visit us. She fell in love with the young man who lived next door. Morris. Your uncle Morris. They got married and moved to Cleveland. They're both gone now, aren't they? You know, I can't picture her. A few years later, we moved to New York. This just jumped into my mind. I must have been 3 years old. We were still in Russia. Mir, a small town, but famous for its yeshiva. My oldest brother, Joe, took our horses down to the river. They were the two best horses in the town. My father had a phaeton, a beautiful old buggy. He was like a taxi driver. He took people to Minsk or Vilna. That day he was at the station, the passenger station, waiting for customers. My brother was still just a kid. He must have been washing the horses in the river. I can remember. It was a hot day. Maybe he was giving them a drink. And while I was watching, the reins got caught around a pole in the river. The horses kept twisting the reins around that pole. It was slippery. The reins kept sliding down under the water, and they were pulling the horses down with them. I ran into town and got my father, who came running back with a knife in his teeth. He jumped into the river with all his clothes on. He took the knife and sawed away at the reins until he finally cut through. He saved the horses. I haven't thought about this in 1,000 years. It's like a dream. You get up, it's forgotten. Then it all comes back. Didn't I ever tell you? Look at me. I'm starting to cry. What's there to cry about? Such an old, old memory. Why should it make me cry? I wanted to tell my mother about this poem, and this is what came out of that conversation. He tells his mother what he's working on. I'm writing a poem about you. You are? What's it about? It's the story about your childhood, the horses in the river. The ones that nearly drowned? I saved them. You told it to me just a few weeks ago. I should dig up more of my memories. I wish you would. Like when I lived on the farm and one of the girls fell down the well? Yes. I forget if it was Rose or Pauline. It was a deep well. I remember that story. Have you finished your poem? I'm still working on it. You mean you're correcting it with commas and semicolons? Exactly. When can I see it? As soon as it's finished. Is it an epic? It's not that long. No, I mean all my thoughts, the flashes of what's going through my life, the whole family history, living through the woe, the river and the water. I know. Will it be published? I have to finish it first. It's better to write about real life. That's more important than writing something fanciful. I try to write all my poems about real life. You see, the apple never falls far from the tree. I guess not. You're my apple. There's probably a worm crawling through that apple. Then it's got something sweet to chew on. Well, you're my tree. Yes, I'm your tree. You're an apple. I'm a tree. I think it meant something to this audience to hear my mother represented in her own words, and I was glad I read. After the conference, I went downstairs to visit her. She seemed, as always, happy to see me, and I was, as always, relieved when she recognized me. I haven't been showing her any of my poems lately, but I told her about reading some of them at the conference, and since I had it with me, I decided to show her The Two Horses. She started to read it out loud. She just had a cataract operation, and her vision is still dicey, so she had a little trouble making out the words. Sometimes she got lost and had to read the same passage over and over again. But the thing that really got to me was that as she was reading, she looked up and said, "This is about me, isn't it?"
Lord Schwartz is director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. His most recent book of poems is Goodnight, Gracie. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews a PBS special on the making of the TV series Homicide. This is Fresh Air. Tonight, many public television stations are presenting a two-hour special devoted to a program from commercial television, NBC's Homicide: Life on the Street. The special is a behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of a specific episode of Homicide, followed by a showing of that entire episode, minus the commercials. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Is this something public TV should be doing? Spending its time and resources deconstructing a primetime series from a rival, more popular network? And rerunning in its entirety a program that already was shown once on that same network? Of course it is. One of the things that drives me nuts about television, even more so than Donnie and Marie getting their own talk show, is that the medium usually refuses to take itself seriously. Yet the premise behind Theodore Boghossian's new documentary, Anatomy of a Homicide: Life on the Street, is that even commercially produced TV, under the right circumstances and in the right hands, can turn out to be a great work of art. He's right, and he couldn't have picked a better show or a better episode to study. Boghossian and his cameras were there in the summer of 1997 when Homicide executive producers Barry Levinson and Tom Fontana held a planning meeting for the upcoming season with their staff of writer-producers. One of them, James Yoshimura, described an idea he got from watching an HBO documentary called Taxicab Confessions. An NYPD cop telling his cab driver about the worst thing he's ever seen on duty tells him about a subway accident where the guy fell between the train and the platform and was wedged there, with the bottom half of his body twisted like a pretzel. Yet the guy's alive and conscious until they free the pressure on his body, at which time he'll die almost instantly. As Yoshimura described this horror, Fontana and the other producers instantly caught on to the dramatic possibilities in adapting it to their edgy and risky TV show.
So I heard that and I said, That's a perfect homicide episode.
So our guys are called there because
it is a homicide.
Somebody's been pushed.
Right. It's considered a homicide. I mean, it's going to be considered a homicide because, you know, the guy's going to die.
So there's a kind of a race to get somebody there, but before they, because they're going to say it in an hour, 40 minutes, we're going to
They're getting pressure from the transit people, right, to get the trains moving.
Yeah, that's part of it, too.
Because the heart of it is the guy's going to die anyway. Right. So
it is the perfect homicide episode. And Boghossian's anatomy shows how it was produced, as well as what compromises were made along the way. We get to see Yoshimura writing the first drafts of his script on an electric typewriter, not a computer, and getting notes from Fontana and the network. We watch him wait nervously for a guest star to be cast as the ill-fated commuter. Then we watch that guest star, Vincent D'Onofrio of Full Metal Jacket, do some terrific acting with Andre Brower as Detective Frank Pembleton. We get to see the battles over how many extras can be hired and how many expletives can be included. We see the guest director, Gary Fleeter of the film Kiss the Girls, trying to adapt to the more rigorous schedule of a weekly TV drama. We also hear from critics and NBC executives and cast and crew members, all of whom offer their take on homicide in general and this subway episode in particular. Then, after all that, we get to sit back and watch the episode from start to finish. And even though Boghossian's documentary has revealed all the magician's tricks involved in mounting this homicide show, that magic still works. It's an hour of great TV, preceded in this case by a great hour about great TV. One final thought. PBS should treat this anatomy lesson as a pilot and blueprint for a continuing American Masters-type series of specials. I can imagine, and would love to watch, similar behind-the-scenes documentaries on other quality TV shows, followed by complete episodes. Shows devoted to The Simpsons, The Practice, Frasier, The X-Files, and NYPD Blue, just to name a few. Watch Anatomy of a Homicide, and you'll know why I'm so impressed. And if you're not a homicide fan when you start watching this PBS special, by the time it's over, you will be.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Levenger, Tools for Serious Readers. Catalog information available, 800-544-0880. This is NPR, National Public Radio.